There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The XX GabFest is brought to you by 23andMe. Get to know your DNA by ordering your personal genetic profile from 23andMe. You'll get new knowledge to help you make more informed decisions about your health. Order your 23andMe DNA kit today at the new price of just $99 at 23andMe.com/GabFest.
Welcome to the XX GabFest for Thursday, June 13th, the Our Fathers Necessary edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, editor of XX, talking to you from the DC studio, and I am joined in New York today by Allison Benedict, the other XX editor. Hi, Allison.
Hi, Hannah.
And also the lovely Noreen Malone from The New Republic. Hi, Noreen.
Hey, Hannah.
So our three topics today are, first, we're going to talk about Lauren Sandler's excellent new book called One and Only, which argues that we might all be happier if we just had one child. Second, on the occasion of Father's Day, we're going to discuss the sort of obnoxious topic, do we really need fathers? Just to welcome all the fathers in. And third, the wedding gift. The wedding gift. Is it time to get rid of it? That's our third topic. So let's go to our first. In her new book, One and Only, author Lauren Sandler, who's going to join us today, makes the case for why having one child is the best choice. She counters all the usual stereotypes about only children, that they're selfish, lonely, aloof, unsocialized, can't share their toys, and grow up to be maladjusted adults. She also makes a very good case why, given right now our overintense parenting culture, having an only child is the best way to stay happy in your marriage. Welcome to the show, Lauren.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Great. Now, I have to say, it's going to be a tough haul for you because you're kind of fighting an uphill battle in this crowd. Allison and I both have three children. Noreen comes from a family of a million children and will surely have a million children herself someday. So let's argue about it. I think your book makes an excellent case. And maybe I'll just start at the beginning, which is a little eggheady, but the work of G. Stanley Hall, he's like always the villain in every child argument. But I didn't realize you argue that the stereotypes about only children come from this very old and untested place, right? So can you talk a little bit about what the stereotypes are?
Well, the clinical basis for it comes from this old, untested place. You know, I think that there's also something that goes even deeper. You know, there was an evolutionary purpose to having larger families. That's how a species could thrive. And then when we were an agrarian society, children were a labor force and a life insurance policy. That's who you needed to tend the farm. But then we got into the birth of child psychology, and the man who's sort of credited with birthing child psychology in the United States is indeed this person who is always villainized. And I wish that we could show a picture of him, because he really does look like such a classic villain, his like glinting black eyes. He was someone who was raised in rural Massachusetts with a ton of kids all around him. And frankly, methods for studying psychology hadn't really been developed yet. And so he took his personal bias and he took his observations, which are incredibly bizarre if you read through them. They're actually quite entertaining reading, comparing only children to various types of animals. And he basically said, yeah, being an only child is a disease in itself. It was the world's greatest pull quote, and it went everywhere. And because he had such a strong following, there were Hall clubs all over the country to spread his teachings, it really sunk in, and it felt like this bias that people had was legitimized for the first time. Now, about 10 years later, some methods had been developed to actually test his claims, and people started doing the real research and found all of it to be fairly fraudulent. And over 100 years, there have been hundreds of studies that show that being an only child is not worse. In fact, it's pretty much the same, except we do tend to have higher achievement motivation, and we do better on IQ tests, and sometimes, you know, we have some higher self-esteem. But other than that, Hall was really full of it, and yet it really stuck. So we've been fighting that for a long time now. And not only have only children been fighting it, as an only child myself, I wasn't aware of this stigma so much as an only child. It's parents who have to fight it, because as a parent of an only child, you are considered someone who is inflicting this horribleness onto your child.
One thing I thought,
only when I had my own only child that I started really hearing it.
One thing that I thought you did a great job with was sibling rivalry, which I've been thinking about a lot because there's been a lot of recent study about how toxic sibling rivalry actually is, and this idea that you get a false sense of identity and a false sense of your place inside the family because of sibling rivalry, which we've often dismissed as, oh, it's just natural, it's just what siblings do. But you know, that is something a kid is spared, obviously, if they're an only child. The idea that they get to form their own identity without having it formed in relationship to two other people who happen to be their siblings.
Yeah, I mean, frankly, I don't knock siblings. I just kind of say, you know, if you don't want to have more kids, you're not going to screw up your kid because of that. There are plenty of other ways to screw up your kid. I do think that kids do learn from siblings, but they learn from the conflict, not the companionship. And studies have shown that conflict happens just as acutely often in school. So as long as your kid goes to school and gets exposed to other kids, that kid will get socialized.
It's so just don't have
it's
one kid.
Not as dark as we think it is.
Don't homeschool your one kid.
Exactly. If okay. You're homeschooling your only child, there are probably other issues at play that might be a greater influence than, say, family size.
One of the most compelling parts of the book to me was when you talk about how parenting has swallowed us whole, that between working and childcare and housework, we really don't have time to do, you know, to engage with the world, to socialize with other adults or to volunteer. But I'm curious if you think that actually has to do with family size, or is this really about parenting culture? And no matter how many kids you have, even if it's just one kid, that kid sort of fills up all the empty space you have in your life, because that's how we approach parenting these days.
Well, I'm so glad you're asking that, because that's so much of why I wrote this book, because I do think that things are crazy right now. I think that the biggest issue, frankly, is our lack of policy. You know, I did a lot of reporting in Europe, and you hang out with people who are talking about how hard it is, and you think, wait a minute, you have state-sponsored daycare and free health care, and your kid's going to go to a great college that you don't have to pay for. And so the fact is that, yes, even there it can be hard. Our parenting culture is crazy, and I do think that everyone needs to chill out a bit. But I think it's especially tough in the United States, where we're working more than ever, we're parenting more than ever, and we have less help than anyone else to do it.
Yeah, your list of the things that you'd like to have in life, you know, your meaningful work, travel, being known, that kind of broke my heart. I don't think I really checked a lot of those boxes off, you know. I mean, I have meaningful work, I travel sometimes, but it was this idea of a sort of planned life that I think you kind of lose control of when you have a lot of children.
Well, I think that's true, but I mean, Hannah, it's so great to talk to you about this, because you have, you know, I thought of you a lot when I was writing this book as the counterexample, you know, the sort of like, how does Hannah do it? You have three kids, you travel, you have the work life that you have, you know. By all accounts, it seems like you're doing the thing that seems most impossible
but
to me.
But she's miserable.
No, I'm not at all miserable.
Either was, I don't have to do it, you know.
Yeah.
I don't have to do it not to screw up my kid. I can have one kid and do the work that I want to do, be who I want to be, have the marriage that I want, read the books that I want, go to the rock shows that I want, I will be okay.
Right. I think that in my case, I'm a terrible planner, and it's not that I love chaos the way some people love chaos. I just like, I'm like, it'll be fine. They're so cute. Why not another one? I'm not that thoughtful when I plan my life. That's the truth of it. So I don't sit down and make a list of the things that I want. I just sort of, things happen and then I deal with them. That's my philosophy of life.
Well, that sounds like a totally different type of liberation, and I envy it.
Well, I feel like the three of us have to start defending the many children front. Allison, I'm going to make you go first because you just had your third child. So you must be in your head justifying the goodness of that cute baby.
Well, let me just say, I don't think Lauren's book is asking us to justify it. I mean, from what I get from it, it's not, you know, it's she's not saying that that this is that ours is the wrong choice and hers is the right choice. She's just saying hers does not have to be the wrong choice, how it's often seen.
No, but there is an element of your book that's about happiness, which I actually found that's the place that where you're really pushing us. And I think that's important to really push us. So, yes, you're not judging. And I'm sure when your friends have two or three kids, that's fine. But I think the place where your book really gets provocative and interesting is when you say, hey, everyone, think about this. You know, it's not an environmental question. It's like we're driving ourselves crazy. We've made ourselves really unhappy. So why don't you avail yourself of this out? Which is that studies show that people who have one kid kind of get the best of all worlds and seem happier. They don't experience that great marital happiness drop off that people do with their second or third child.
It's funny because that is, you know, the stereotype of that you're trying to combat of the parent of an only child being selfish. It's actually kind of the opposite, right? Like you are arguing for adults to be more selfish, to think of their own personal happiness more, to consider that when they're making these big life decisions.
Yeah, I really do believe in that. My mother really taught me that to be a good mother, you need to be a happy person. That was at least what her life lesson was. And I really took it to heart. I also feel like, obviously, Allison and Hannah, you have done an incredible job of remaining engaged in the world and helping to, you know, shape things so that we are more aware of our choices and our political engagement as women. That doesn't happen for everyone. And part of my concern in a larger sense is not just about our own happiness, but as we parent more and more, especially as we mother more and more, we get locked deeper inside that domestic cocoon, which means we're not engaging with what else is happening out there in the same way. And I feel like if we really want to see any social change in our culture, if we want better schools, if we want a better system for parenting, if we want, you know, to keep pushing the world in the right direction, it's hard to do that when you are so focused inward into a domestic life. And so for me, I feel like in terms of the social benefit of parents, especially mothers having only children, there is an argument to make, but it doesn't mean that it's what everyone needs to do. I just wanted to push awareness in a certain direction that I think we haven't quite been discussing yet.
Well, I want to push back a little bit. Again, I'm the only person here who's not a mother, so you can all feel free to tell me how wrong I am. But, you know, I think there are some people who can, you know, retreat into a domestic sphere fully after one child, and some who, you know, can have like eight and maybe remain engaged in a certain way. I also think that, you know, having children doesn't necessarily mean I don't think you retreat by a factor of, two every time you have a child.
But I think what happens is, Noreen, is that you extend the period in which you're dealing with children for a long time. So what I see about my friends who have only one child is that they've been able to fully become adults pretty close to what they were like, you know, before they had children now, because they have one child and that child has grown older and is more independent and they're not going through the cycles over and over and over again. But Noreen, I would be interested in your take, not on the parenting culture, but I know you're very close with your sister, and you have more than one sister. And I just wonder, you know, what that has done for you or your own identity and relationship to your sisters, because that's hard to quantify or say how important that is. But I'd be interested in hearing you talk about it because you had a lot of kids in the family.
Yeah. I'm one of six kids and I'm close with all of my sisters. And I think it's been a huge part of my identity. Actually, you know, when you do those stupid little icebreakers at, you know, group things and people say, well, say one fun fact about yourself, I always say I'm from a really big family, which is, you know, sort of a boring thing to say. But it's enough a part of my identity that it's something I want people to know about. And I was sort of wondering that while you were talking, Lauren, if that's so much a part of my identity, to be an only child must be a part of your identity too, and it shapes you in a different way. So maybe not negatively, but what are the ways in which, you know, like what are the myths that old only children tell themselves about themselves in the world? You know, like do they say I'm higher achieving because I've been, you know, I spent this much time with adults or whatever? Or, you know, do they buy into the sort of the negative myths about themselves?
Well, I have found that for people who really define themselves as only children, it becomes the totalizing narrative to explain all these things about them. Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, for example, in the book, there's a married couple. They're both only children. One of them is a total loner. She says that she is a loner because she's an only child. Her husband is super, super social. He says that he's super, super social because he's an only child.
Mm-hmm.
They're both probably right. But, you know, it's funny, I didn't carry around a very strong only child identity when I was a kid. I think that some people do, but I don't think it's really coming from within so much. You know that it's different than having siblings. You always wonder what it's like to have siblings. I mean, when you were describing your closeness with your sisters and life in a family of six, you know, I was feeling so much curiosity and envy and all these things that one feels about someone else's great situation. But when you said it's different, that really is the key. I think it's just different. I don't think that there's a better or worse. And that really is the social story that we've been telling for so long, is that one is worse.
Right. And I have a lot of sympathy for people assuming things about, you know, your personality based on simply the number of siblings or the lack of siblings.
Mm-hmm.
Do we know how often are there numbers on, like, do only children more often have only children? Because I know, you know, a lot of us make sort of fall into the amount of kids we have. I mean, it's not, obviously you have to do something to get pregnant and get it out of you, but you know, I came from two, my husband came from three, and so it was going to sort of fall somewhere around there. And people, I feel like, often have the amount of kids that they grew up with. So, is, you know, how much of, do you think it was a real choice for you to only have one, or it was kind of predetermined?
Well, for only children in general, we tend to, if we have kids at all, have one if we liked it, and have more if we didn't. So, you know, it's an extreme, and one reacts to an extreme in an extreme way. You either run from it or you think that worked out pretty well. For myself, it's funny. I've always thought about having children one at a time. I never imagined myself as a mother with a bunch of kids. I thought, okay, let me see if I can do this. And now that I've done it, let me see how I feel about doing it again. And so I think because I didn't grow up with the given of more kids in a family, I could take that one at a time process in a different way than a lot of people have a tendency to, because it's what's normal to me.
Lauren, one thing I'm interested in is sort of what happens to your sibling relationships later in life. I was actually talking about your book with a close friend who's an only child who wants to have, you know, multiple children. And that's become important to her as her parents have gotten older and she's thought about them dying and sort of being kind of on her own in the world. You know, she hopefully will have a partner and certainly will have a lot of friends, but sort of being the only part of this family unit is a little frightening to her. And I'm curious if you talked to adult only children about, you know, sort of looking off into the abyss.
It is the thing that I think we have most in common. I mean, the abyss is exactly the way to put it. And I can read all the studies I want about how awesome it is to not have siblings. And I can even read studies about how when it comes to elder care, it's usually the closest residing sibling who does the bulk of it. Or if siblings are all nearby, it's always the eldest sister. Like, there's all this data. And the data doesn't add up to that much for me, because there is an existential hole in this question. It's hard. It's hard to think about, and I think about it a lot. You know, my parents are pragmatists, so they have long-term health insurance as a way to help deal with this. You know, they've seen what it's like for their parents to need 24-hour nursing care and how difficult that might be. That can only take us so far. It's going to be hard, and I know that. It'll be hard for me, and if my daughter's an only child, it'll be hard for her. But for me, the question has been, is that reason enough to have another kid?
Mm-hmm.
I've talked to a lot of people who really feel like it is, and they do, and I respect that. But it's a lot to do to keep my existing child from being an only child at the end of my life.
So, Lauren, the basic takeaway from your book is that this should become an option without stigma, right? Like, that's what you want people to take away from this. That
exactly.
If they decide to do that, it's not going to damage their child. It's a perfectly fine decision. It's different. It has different consequences at every phase of life, as does having siblings. But it should just be out on the table as an option with every other option, right?
Which doesn't seem that controversial, right? And yet it is.
Right, right, right. Anyway, I think it's great. I really love your book, and I'm really glad to have you on the show. So thank you for joining us, and I wish you success in your book tour.
And thank you all so much, and good luck with all of your children.
Suckers!
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
Now let's move on to our second topic, are fathers necessary? But before we do, I would like to welcome a new sponsor, 23andMe. 23andMe was Time Magazine's Invention of the Year in 2008. It's one of the most trusted companies where consumers can learn more about their health and ancestry through their DNA. And they've reduced their price to $99, so this Invention of the Year is now accessible to everyone. 23andMe gives you tools to better understand how your genes may impact your health, and it helps you and your doctor find health areas to keep an eye on. It gives you ancestry information so you can discover your global origins or perhaps find living relatives. Oh, this sounds good for only children. Maybe if they're having that family yearning, they can go on 23andMe and find who other people they're related to. And other cool things, results include famous ancestors, how closely you're related to Neanderthals. I think it would be a bummer to discover you're very closely related to Neanderthals, or why you may not like cilantro. That's a weird one, this thing that some people think cilantro tastes like soap. Anyway, ordering your kit is easy. Go online to order your kit. Then you will mail back a saliva sample in the envelope provided, and once they've completed your DNA analysis, they'll send you a notification, and you can access your results online. So order your 23andMe DNA kit today for just $99 at 23andme.com/gabfest. 23andme.com/gabfest. That would be kind of interesting, I think, to know various things about myself and my ancestry. I'm not one of those people who's ever, like, looked up. Have you guys ever looked up, like, your family lines or anything like that?
No, my mom does that sometimes.
Your mom does that? There's one genealogist in the Plotz family, but my family is, like, lost to broken Jewish history. Anyway, let's move on to our next topic. To get ready for Father's Day, we decided to take up the nice topic of, are fathers necessary? In a world where women are increasingly raising children alone, we have to wonder whether we need fathers at all. On the one hand, there are the stats that are recited by Obama and others, that kids who grow up without fathers are more likely to live in poverty and drop out of school and commit crimes. And on the other hand, a growing body of research by lesbian families, by single mothers, says all that you need is one committed parent, and it doesn't matter what the gender of that parent is. So the question is, if the fathers are not stepping up, should we bother with them? Noreen, I'm going to ask you about some of the studies that are out there. Like, when you were looking into this, what did you find the study said about fathers, or what's the state of the research?
Sure. So there was a big study that came out in maybe 2010 that made a splash. Academics named Timothy Biblars and Judith Stacey. And basically what they found is pretty intuitive that the quality of the parenting is more important than, for instance, the gender of the parent. You know, so if you have, let's say, two, and in fact, as we might have touched on last podcast in our discussion of what straights can learn from gay marriages, two lesbian parents will often score much higher than a traditional, you know, mom and dad will on a number of different measures of sort of engagement, being engaged with their child, and you know, measures of love, if you believe you can measure love. And then there are other studies that show, in addition to quality of parenting, what really matters is the class of the parent, the sort of socioeconomic class. And that all sort of makes sense to me, unfortunately.
Yeah, so it's like kids are struggling. Kids who are in single mother households are struggling, not necessarily because they're missing a father, per se, but because single mother families tend to be poorer. Now, I don't know if that's slicing it too finely. You know, maybe they just would be better off with a father. That's how we've always done it. Or maybe this is just a poverty question. Like, you're perfectly fine. This is what Katie Royfe is always arguing in Slate. It's not so much single motherhood that's the problem. If you're a single mother with resources and reasonable family connections and you're devoted to your children it really doesn't make any difference.
Completely. But then what you mentioned Obama in your intro, and that's what's interesting to me. He's the president of the United States of America. He's a success by any measure. And he was raised really without a father. And that has clearly figured hugely in his psychology. You know, he wrote a whole book, Dreams from My Father. And he has, you know, he brings it up as a talking point. And so that's where I sort of, that's where it gets into a fuzzier, less quantifiable area.
Well, it's always like going to be outliers. But I mean, would we ever, we came up with this topic idea because there was a room for debate in the New York Times with the headline, What Are Fathers For? A room for debate as if, like, you know, we see both sides.
Right.
They're not necessarily they are. But would we ever ask this question of mothers? And I don't really, I sort of take issue with the question to begin with.
What do you mean?
What are mothers for? I mean, other than, you know, as once the baby's out, we've got formula. what's the difference?
Well, I think if you look at these studies, I mean, you know, the fact that two lesbian parents do tend to score higher on all these measures than two gay dads does tell you something about, like, maybe just, you know, it's the same way. You know, the SATs are gamed towards people from a wealthier household. You know, measures of parenting are geared towards women. But it does tell you that regardless of sexuality, the genders parents tend to parent slightly differently.
I think you go down a dangerous road with this. I think you're right, Allison. It is funny that we ask this question, are fathers necessary? We're asking it for a sociological reason, which is that fathers are increasingly less part of their biological children's lives because fewer people are getting married. And just by default, the children tend to stay with the mothers. And for various economic reasons, the mothers tend to be the one, you know, who get it together. One economist calls this the last one holding the bag theory. It's not that the mothers are better or more suited to take care of their children. It's just they end up with the child. So they end up having to get their act together in order to support that child. And the fathers increasingly drop out of the picture. So it's more a sociological picture than it is a kind of gender essentialist picture. If somehow we could, you know, tweak that and have the kids end up with the father, I think it would be largely the same debate. I mean, my argument, I wrote a piece for this room for debate, is that actually a family doesn't need a father, but that men need fatherhood. That this sort of spiral we've gotten into where men are not taking care of their children because they are not working, or certain working class men, they're not working, they can't provide for the children, and that ends up putting them in a spiral where so they don't take care of the children, and then they don't work because they have no children to take care of, and they have no real incentive to have to work at a job that they don't really want to work at because the children are not dependent on them anymore. And so you have a situation where increasingly the father's just not that big a part of the picture. And I'm a little, I don't know what to think about that. I mean, I can argue myself into the kind of good feminist position that we don't really need fathers. It doesn't matter. The lesbians are the better parents. But I feel like it can't really be true.
Yeah, why are daddy issues, like, why are daddy issues everywhere in our culture if we don't need them, right? Like, why, you know, how many shrinks would go out of business if we didn't actually need fathers? How many reality TV plot lines would never happen if...
I mean, maybe also need is the wrong word. I mean, I mean, kids don't need any parents, I guess.
Right.
You can go survive in an orphanage. It sure wouldn't be pleasant. But, the question of what two parents, whatever the gender is, or the more support a child has in the family, I think most people agree the better. I'm curious what you
now,
guys...
Now, I think if you have money, it doesn't make that much of a difference, right? Like, if you're an upper-class, educated family, and you're a single mother, or you're a lesbian family, it's like Lauren Sandler said about only children, it's a different way of bringing up a child. It probably has good things about it, makes you more open-minded, more accepting. It probably has slight downsides, which if you're, you know, a son of lesbians, you might wonder, you might, you know, think a lot about what it's like to have a father. I mean, it's just a different form of
upbringing. I don't know if I think that's true. I mean, I'm just going to, like, give a personal anecdote that my husband grew up without a father around and with money. Mm-hmm. And he has always had a hole. I mean, he feels that something was missing.
And how does he talk about it? I mean, because there are the exceptions. These hard-driving, like Bill Clinton, didn't have a father either, you know? So what is it to him? Like, what does he say missing?
It defined him. Mm-hmm.
Well, and Bill,
it defines the kind of father he is now, too, I think.
And I think Bill Clinton, you know, much like Obama, you know, can probably is probably preoccupied with certain things because of, you know, we are not privy to Bill Clinton's psychological issues, but we sort of are, you know.
I'm curious what you guys think about this. Recently, my husband and I were talking on the about the Pew study that came out saying that women are increasingly becoming the breadwinners in their families. And we were talking about whose fault is it that fathers are kind of are dropping out. And my husband's argument was that though Women's Lib was a largely a positive force for this country, that has has in some way taught men that they're not necessary, that women doing it for themselves mean that we don't need men in our lives and that our children don't need men. And has that actually caused men to allowed men or even sort of maybe forced men out of the family structure?
Hannah Rosen, world-leading expert on this.
The world's leading expert. It has. And then it's just, you know, there are two sides of you, one that wants to just tell the men to step up and get their act together, and the other that sees this as like a deep, deep sociological force. You know, one of the things I write about in my book is, you know, the matriarchy has some negative consequences. As the matriarchy sets down roots, investment in children, like whether you're going to send your child to college, that's a real thing. Like investing in a firstborn son is something that people actually did do. They would save up their money and send their son to college. Now they do that for the girls, right? So if there's like a working class family in which the mother's been heading the family, they are much more likely to pull their resources together and send the girl to college. And so what you have is a deepening of this idea that the boys are the kind of dropouts of society. And that's not great. Now, you know, the way that your husband put it, Allison, makes it sound like the women's fault in some way, right? It's like, oh, you uppity women, like now that you can run your own family, we feel rejected. So that's like the construct that a dude.
But is it really different?
Is it different than what?
I mean, is the way that he puts it and the way that you put it really different at heart?
But in his formulation, what are you supposed to do? Like, are you supposed to, is the woman just supposed to, you know, not pretend like she needs the man who's not working and not contributing to the family? Like, what is a woman supposed to do? As opposed to the different question, what's society supposed to
right.
do?
Right. Okay.
Can we just pause and say how wild it is that we're even like talking about this and the New York Times is having this room for debate? Like that in and of itself signals something, you know, that the fact that like having a two-parent family structure almost sounds like you're discussing like an alternative arrangement, you know, that we're defending it as just right. as good as like a two-lesbian.
And that actually upsets me. I mean, I feel in this conversation very conservative, but...
No, I sort of do too.
Well, you know, I went back and read Caitlin Flanagan's review of this Peggy Drexler book, which is called Raising Boys Without Men, which was written a few years ago in the mid-2000s. And I feel like, okay, there was a point when we were just starting to think about gay marriage and kind of imagine its legalization, when we felt that we really had to defend these alternative family structures no matter what. And Caitlin Flanagan makes the point that Peggy Drexler is exaggerating a lot, you know, that she really goes out of her way to find these studies showing we really don't need dads at all. And I found myself agreeing with Caitlin Flanagan. Like, there was a moment when we had to really bully these arguments in, and maybe now we are moving towards that other moment as we come to legalize gay marriage and as we come to be a country that does accept alternative family structures, that recognizes that we have a huge number of single mothers who are heads of households, that we can let the men, we can relax around this topic. It doesn't have to be so ideological, and we can admit that the men are in trouble and need our help, and we need some help supporting family structures, that's the next wave of this conversation is like, okay, we get it. Alternative families, fine. Now let's worry about the men who are in trouble or not connected to their families or to the boys who are growing up without fathers or whatever. Like, we
some
can actually
men.
Worry about that now.
Some men are not. Can I, like, I like the idea of relaxing around this issue in general. That
right.
Relaxing is always something I'm in favor of.
Relax. Okay. Anybody else have anything more to say on the fatherhood topic?
No.
Happy Father's Day, Dad.
Happy Father's Day. That's right. My dad was sick and I even forgot to call him this week. So happy Father's Day. Okay. Let's move on to our third topic. In a Slate piece this week, Matt Iglesias argues that it's time to get rid of what he calls the aggravating convention of the wedding gift, which he says are wasteful, unfair, and inefficient. Once upon a time, brides and grooms needed those gifts, he argues. They were young and likely to be coming straight from their parents' house, and the woman would be expected to cook but have no pots to do it in. Nowadays, couples are likely to be already living together and have all the stuff they need. Plus, married couples already have so many advantages over singles that piling gifts on top of this is just not fair. So I will start with you, Allison. When you were getting married, what was the gift situation like? Were you guys already living together? Did you get lots of pots and pans? Like, what was your experience of your haul?
We were living together. I was young, though. I mean, by today's standards, I was 26. And we got everything that we have today. I mean, I do not agree with Matt. I would support if he was making the case based on, you know, materialism, that we shouldn't have to acquire all this stuff, I might support it. Also, if he was making the case against thank you notes, and that case meant that we were not able to get presents so that we no longer have to write thank you notes, I would agree. But I think it's you know, and if you don't want your friends to give you gifts because they have to travel far away for your destination wedding, I'm all for that. But in general, the idea that just because we're getting married later, we don't need the stuff, I don't really get it. I mean, I think everything's delayed now. So I don't think, you know, people out of college are acquiring nice stuff or keeping it nice. One of his arguments is that we should get this stuff for people after they graduate from college. And I think that's crazy. You get like a nice set of Calphalon for a 22-year-old kid. He's going to burn it or, you know, use it for some sort of drug paraphernalia or lose it in one of his moves.
Making crack?
Like, yeah.
What is he doing?
It seems ludicrous to me. I think that, you know, if two people move in together when they're young and then get married when they're 32, probably they have all of their, they've combined all of their crappy stuff, and it's nice for them to get nice stuff.
So, okay, here, my situation is much like yours because I was 27 when I got married and I had nothing. I did not have a pot or a pan or anything. And so what I registered for was extremely basic stuff like pots and pans and a KitchenAid. That was like the big expensive gift that all my friends got together and, you know, pulled in for. And that is my entire kitchen to this day. So I suppose that's very traditional because David and I did not live together and so we didn't have any shared items. But now I am invited to weddings of friends who are getting married when they're older, right? My friends who are around 40. And I feel that they're going to extreme lengths. Like recently I was invited to a wedding where these people had been working for a long time and had a lot of money and were living together and they didn't really need anything. So they asked people to bring them art or artistic gifts or creative gifts. And this was like, I feel like people have to go out of their way to ask for things since they already have so many things. And so it becomes like very difficult. The bar gets really, really high. Like David thought of a great gift, which he's given to a couple of people, which is a guided tour around whatever neighborhood they live in, like in Chicago or New York. That's kind of a cool gift. Like you can choose the afternoon that you take it, or experiential gifts, like buy people tickets to things. But it's become this thing where you have to look really hard because people have all their stuff. Like Noreen, do you have stuff? Do you have pots and pans? Like, do you have things that, you know, you need to sustain you through life?
Yeah. And I am slowly acquiring more things, and I'm trying to be thoughtful about what I acquire, and like I want it to last. And so I'm a person to whom this should totally appeal, right? Matt's argument, like I would have loved to, like, you know, have a wedding shower when I was 23, or like a new apartment shower, sorry, like upon graduating from college and getting, you know, all the things that I would need. That would make a lot of sense for me. But I hate his argument. I'm reacting against it in like a, I know it's an economic argument and I know I should accept it on those terms. And I know that like the way you guys are talking about it makes sense too. But like I'm reacting to it in this really emotional way that like wedding gifts, I have a really emotional response to gifts in general. But I think that just the idea, like my mom can still tell you, you know, who gave her. She has, you know, a lot of things from her wedding still, some of which are quite beautiful, some of which are quite useful, some of which are god-awful ugly. But she can tell you who gave it to her, you know, 40 years later. And I think that's great.
Shouldn't it be about emotions? I mean, the whole, like, it's the thought, it's the feeling that counts. I think, you know, Matt makes a case that it's not, that it's inefficient, that gifts, wedding gifts, and I think kind of gifts in general are inefficient. But who cares? I mean, what's the
exactly?
What do we give and get gifts for?
Right, and it's right. They're a symbol of your affection for someone, right? And also with wedding gifts in general, right? Like so that maybe the traditional idea that you're, you know, setting this young couple up in housekeeping isn't quite true, but the symbol behind it, that it's this community of people who sort of standing up and recognizing their love for one another. I think that's still there. And like maybe that comes in the form of artwork or like, you know, donations to some charitable organization in Peru, or you name a star after them or whatever the fuck you're going to do. But like, I think there's something really beautiful about that. And I'm cheesy, but I don't care.
Let me also
okay,
say
you're
that
romantic.
We never registered for bed linens because we couldn't agree, because we never agree on anything. And to this day, 10 years later, we still don't have any. We should have just gotten them then.
Also,
wait, what do you mean? What do you sleep on?
I mean, we have like sheets from Target, but not like it doesn't, nothing matches.
Also, right. If you get rid of wedding gifts, you get rid of gift registries, which is like a great way to, it's a great source of gossip. Like, I don't know if you've ever sort of like looked at someone's registry and been like, ooh, that's so tacky. She registered for like the most expensive possible thing. Like no one's ever going to get, like they're also like, to offset my saccharineness, there's also like a good source of sort of material culture analysis.
So that's my counter to your argument. I think it used to be that people gave certain traditional things, like the family would get together and get china, and you know, the friends would do this or that. But now, like, you're just bullied by the couple into getting exactly what they want. So it seems to bleed all of the, you know, the sort of love and emotional significance out of it, because all I'm doing is like checking the box on Amazon or...
And they know exactly how much you spent.
They know exactly how much I spent, and it's like nothing I would personally choose for someone. It's just what they want. And so, yeah, I suppose maybe at some level it has my little stamp on it because they know that I'm the one who got plate 6 and plate 7.
But for close friends, you can go off registry, I think, if you know, and I usually do, if you know someone's taste and it matters to you enough that you're going to spend some time picking that out, you can do that. What a lot of people do now is they register for a bare minimum of stuff with the idea that, you know, they're not asking for cash, but they sort of are by registering for, like, you know, far fewer items than there are people attending the wedding. And I'm curious if you guys think that's tacky.
People give cash?
Oh, my gosh. Event? Yeah. People really want cash.
I wish that we had
so
got
tacky.
No, I don't know. I mean, I also think it's like cultural. There are some Italian weddings mm-hmm. that people bring money to the wedding. I mean, there are plenty of sort of traditions that involve bringing cash to a wedding, but I wish I had gotten cash. Well, I mean, I guess I would have blown it, but
a little bit also, I mean, I think the idea being that, you know, so many people are spending crazy amounts on weddings now that it sort of does offset that cost. But then, I mean, then that's crazy to think about. Like, you're asking people to sort of pay their own way to a wedding, essentially, for like $100 plate of chicken that's sort of dry.
I will say, Hannah, what you said about your, you know, older friends getting married and they already have all their stuff. I do support. I don't support banning wedding gifts, but I do support not that it's really a realistic proposal, but I do support that if you're getting married and you have all the stuff, don't make people go out of their way to get an artistic present. Just say give to charity or don't give gifts. I mean, I'm okay with that. I just think, like, as much as, you know, people are getting married later, I don't think it's the norm that people getting married later already have everything they need. Everyone's not rich.
Right. And yeah. And people make do with like one or two pots and pans.
Right.
Right. Okay. We'll leave it at that. Everyone's not rich. Okay. Let's move on to our recommendations. Allison, why don't you go first today?
Okay, I'm going to recommend a really difficult story to read that I actually wrote about a little bit this week. But over the weekend, the Washington Post ran a story by Eli Saslow about the family of one of the victims of the Newtown shooting, about the parents and how they are coping or not coping in the 6 months since. And the 6 month anniversary of the shooting is tomorrow. And it is just a really grueling read, a pretty amazing piece of writing. And it came to my attention from someone just tweeting, "This is important." And that's like pretty much all I could say about it. It's important. And I suggest you read it. It's called After Newtown Shooting, Mourning Parents Enter Into the Lonely Quiet, on the Washington Post.
Yeah, and it's an amazing story. It's about mourning and grief in general. You know, it's like it's a story about mourning a child, basically, yeah. In the backdrop of Newtown and just having to sort of step up and go to meetings and, you know, make the death of a child meaningful. But I think it's just anyone who's it's relatable to anyone who's lost a child or is in mourning. It's a really amazing story.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll go next. You know, I had a recommendation, but right now all I have on my brain is this unbelievable fact that yet another Republican is talking about pregnancy and rape. And I know this isn't a recommendation, but like, what's wrong with them? You know, like that we've already had so much writing about this in the election. This is Representative Trent Franks, who again went on the floor and said the incidence of rape resulting in pregnancy are very low. As Emily Bazelon has pointed out, this is all based on old Nazi research. And so I just don't understand, like, how with these talking points they would keep stepping their foot in this issue again and again.
So your recommendation is for them not to do that.
I don't know what my recommendation is. I just find that my recommendation is like, why do they keep doing this same, committing this? Why do people commit the same mistake over and over again? It just seems insane. No, my actual recommendation is this book. Did I recommend this last week, that book about fatherhood, or was I saving it for this week?
No, you didn't.
I didn't. That Doing the Best I Can, the one I want to review.
You didn't recommend it.
Okay. So my actual recommendation is a book called Doing the Best I Can by Catherine Eden and Timothy Nelson. These are my absolute favorite sociologists. I am sure that the average listener to this podcast is not in the habit of buying academic books, but I think these guys are so interesting. They have done a many-year study of inner city fathers, and it will just change your mind about what is going on with these fathers that we talked about that are dropping out of their kids' lives. They come up with completely counterintuitive conclusions based on years and years of living in this inner city Philadelphia, and it's just really eye-opening and not what you expect as an explanation of what's going on with fathers and their kids. So I recommend everyone take a look at it. Noreen?
I have a couple. They're both about friendship. One is high and one is low. So on the highbrow end, the New Yorker's online culture section ran a piece by Michelle Dean this week. On the friendship between Hannah Arendt and Mary McCarthy. I hadn't known that they were close friends, but they corresponded and were friends throughout their life, and were just sort of these very different women in these intellectual circles in the New York of that time. And I especially loved a line near the end. They both expressed sort of anti-feminist views at various points. And there was a line from Michelle Dean that I really liked. The problem with sisterhood, the idea of a sunny alliance on the basis of a shared feminine fate, has always been that it deprives women of all individual taste, history, and temperament. In short, it can insist that women not be human beings. And I thought that was sort of a something that I like to think of in this era of leaning in circles. And my other recommendation on the totally other end of the spectrum is The League. Have you guys watched The League on FX? My sister got me into this. It's so bro-ish. It's like so bro-ish, but it's just, it's a really fun depiction of male friendship. Not entirely feminist, so don't question my bona fides there, but like it's really entertaining. And you don't have to, I hate football and like discussions of fantasy football. It's about a group of guys who has a fantasy football league. And there's nothing that makes my eyes glaze over more than someone talking about his fantasy football team. But you really don't have to care about that stuff to like this show.
Okay. Well, thank you both for joining me. Thank you to our listeners. Thank you to Chris Wade for engineering this podcast. Thank you, as always, to Andy Bowers, who's the executive producer of all the Slate podcasts. Please, as always, come on the XX Facebook page and engage with us. Tell us what you want to talk about. Answer some of our questions. Tell us we're annoying, that our voices are weird. Whatever you want to tell us. We always look forward to hearing from you. For Allison Benedict and Noreen Malone, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we will see you in 2 weeks.